Hey folks, Rob here from the Jungle Apocalypse. And before we get into this week's show, I just wanted to tell you about our special that's ending December 31st. As many of you know, the Conspiracy Channel has been working very hard to provide a platform for alternative media to escape the bounds of censorship that's happening quickly on YouTube, as we're all starting to see with this whole Pizzagate thing. So to help support this project, we've opened up a Plus membership. Now, for your Plus membership, you get access to our app on Roku or Fire TV. You get access to shows like The Jungle Apocalypse, Feet to the Fire, American Intelligence Report, Ground Zero Lounge, and more coming all the time, as well as a film archive of over 200 conspiracy and alternative media-based films. And until December 31st, you can get it for a special rate of $6 a month or $50 per year. That's a lifetime rate. As long as you don't cancel your subscription, you will keep that rate even if the price increases. After December 31st, we're going to be increasing the price to $8 a month. So if you want to sign up, now's the time. Go over to conspiracychannel.net and just click the Plus membership button, and you'll get all the information about what we offer and how to sign up. So thanks for your support. We're trying to build an awesome platform here, and it's going really well. So check it out, conspiracychannel.net. And well, let's get started with the show. Hey folks, Rob Davin here from the Jungle Apocalypse Podcast. And this week we're talking with Jay Dyer, the man that has wrote the excellent book Esoteric Hollywood, and his website Jay's Analysis is a treasure trove of various esoteric breakdowns of films and pop culture. So we wanted to have Jay on to kind of continue on in our stream of trying to understand this wild world that is Hollywood and their crazy obsessions they have going on. So Jay, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here. And I want to note as well that there's a whole bunch of other information at the website as well. It's, I think there's only about 120 or 30 film reviews, and there's about 800 or 900 other posts that deal with everything from, you know, philosophy to history to the esoteric to anything in that genre.
Yeah, you have a really good website. I really like your work. It's nice to see somebody doing some really in-depth stuff, you know, like a lot of the stuff we get forwarded is very fluffy and, you know, speculative, and you go in and you're like, you know, pulling out all these old books that we haven't heard of and talking about people that, you know, I've never even heard of and breaking it down. So let's get started talking about your book, Esoteric Hollywood, which hopefully my copy is here in the next couple days. I was hoping to get it here before the interview, but it didn't show up. But what got you started doing this type of analysis?
Well, I studied philosophy in college and in grad school, and so I'm kind of trained as a philosopher, and the whole point of philosophy is to analyze and critically think. And so I also have always enjoyed the arts and acting and comedy and satire and improv and all that. So I tried to find some way that I could combine all these interests. And then, you know, over time, as you do your college career, you are introduced to new things like the history of, say, espionage or spy fiction, or, you know, depending on what you major in. I also studied English lit. So I had all these interests, and I was just looking for a way for all of them to basically coalesce, and the way that I could make a career out of it, because I didn't want to do academia due to what I learned as I got older, which is that the academic realm is very controlled and it's very cliquish, and, you know, if you're not part of the dogmatic orthodoxy of things like Darwinism and social justice warriors and particular views of history and particular views of race and all these different things that you have to believe, you know, in order to most of the time ascend the academic ladder, then, you know, you're kind of stuck. You're kind of at a, and I'm just not usually prone to compromising. So I thought, well, why don't I just start for doing my own thing, because I kind of had a little bit of an entrepreneurial spirit. I thought, you know, I see a lot of the media that I see out there, I thought I could do better than that. And particularly when it came to cultural analysis, pop culture analysis, you know, things like movies and even at times literature or music, even here and there at my site. But mainly I just loved film. And so I thought, why not do an analysis in a way that nobody else has done? And so if you take college classes, you'll do these really in-depth approaches or these really in-depth analyses of anything from film to literature. And then you have to write these long papers on it. And I found that a lot of the times the papers that I was writing were interesting, not just because I think I'm so cool, but because nobody else talks about this. Like, you know, out there in media, nobody ever talks about Dostoevsky. You know, you're not going to hear Dostoevsky mentioned on Fox News or something. So I just thought, you know, people would find this interesting, you know, and the worse that pop culture gets, the more it degenerates, I think the more people are going to be looking for other outlets and other ways to be entertained. Not that my book is purely entertainment, but you know, I just think they're going to be looking for something with a little more substance, not so watered down. And I wanted to kind of provide an avenue for how to look at the arts and look at film in a new way. And what that does is it combines this sort of philosophical academic approach with a very readable, you know, educational approach, you know, for the man in the street.
Yeah, I really like how you did your analysis of like Kubrick's work and whatnot. What was the first film or experience that you had that kind of opened your eyes to the fact that this is a lot of esoteric and occult symbolism that's going on in these movies in an underlying tone?
I live in a small town growing up, and so when I was in high school, there wasn't much to do. So I joined a secret society. I'm joking. That's a joke, by the way. We don't really have any secret societies in the small town, but no. So when I was in high school, there were two movie stores that were on the corners of my little bitty town. I guess that's like half of the town, right? It's two corners. But so there was you had basically VHS type rental, and there were one store had like a certain concentration on like older action movies, and then another store had a concentration on, you know, like the newer films, like the at the time, the mid-90s or so. So all there was to do was rent movies, you know, or play video games or something, or play guitar. So I was more movie inclined, and my buddies and I would always sit around and watch. I think we watched probably every VHS, you know, in both of those movie stores. And certain films stuck out, even back in high school, as just being really bizarre and like, mm-hmm. What the heck is going on? So I remember David Lynch's Lost Highway, like we went and saw that in the theater, my buddies and I. And I had no idea what was going on in this movie. I just thought it was just the most bizarre thing I'd ever seen. And, you know, we watched Natural Born Killers and these, and mm-hmm. We're like, what is this about? Because there's, you know, it seems to be about mass media in some way, but we didn't really have a conception of mass media back at that time. Anyway, so fast forward, and I think by the late 90s, I remember going to see Conspiracy Theory, believe it or not, the Dick Donner, Mel Gibson movie. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that one kind of stuck with me because I started thinking, well, here you got Patrick Stewart, the captain from Star Trek Next Generation, playing this MK Ultra doctor, right? And yeah. I think MK Ultra is mentioned in the film. And even back then, I was like, this is weird. What does this mean? And then as you get into the conspiracy stuff, you know, you gradually start to figure out, hey, actually, a lot of this stuff is real. It's not just mm-hmm. fiction. And that's what happened in my 20s as I was going to college and grad school. The more that I got into taking film classes and noticing all these parallels, you just start to realize, hey, you know, a lot of these Oliver Stone movies are based on fairly accurate presentations of real events mm-hmm. in some cases. You know, the other films stuck out, particularly the Kubrick ones, because I remember the first time I watched 2001, I had no idea what was going on. So what in the F does this mean?
Oh, you can swear. Go ahead.
And Well, I got in trouble because I told a dirty Hillary joke, and I forgot that I was on actual radio, and they got mad at me. So I said that Hillary got more vagina than Bill or something like that. No, I said, remember when Trump said, grab him in the pussy? Mm-hmm. I said, Hillary was mad because the media was mad because Hillary actually gets more pussy than Trump or something to that effect.
Yeah, not
so. So when we went to the break, the guy was like, man, you cannot say that, dude. I was like, whoa, I'm sorry. Like, don't you have a delay? Can't you just beep this out? Anyway, side story. But so anyway, so yeah, there's always all these movies stick out, you know, certain ones in my mind, and that those conspiracy theory or and then you had The Matrix, and everybody's kind of like, wow, this is crazy cool. And, you know, Keanu Reeves is like, whoa, and he's dodging bullets. But what the heck is this? Is like, it's all reality. It's a simulation. And anybody who takes a philosophy course, you know, one of the first things that some fat nerdy guy in the back of the class is going to ask the first day is like, what if all reality is like The Matrix and it's a simulation, man? It's like one of the first, I guarantee you, if you take a philosophy class, you'll hear that. So I don't know. This conspiracy stuff was getting popular in the early to mid 2000s online. And I was listening to Alex Jones back then. And then I came across an analysis that Michael Hoffman did of the movie Conspiracy Theory. I thought, actually, there's a lot of movies that are this way. Like, it's not just this movie. There's a whole bunch of movies that there's this twilight language, as he calls it, parallel between reality and fiction. And maybe this kind of stuff's operating on a kind of meta level where, you know, people are actually studying the possibility of manipulating people's perception of reality through fiction. And so that's what I pursued in my grad work, was that very topic. And then that gets you into figures like Umberto Eco, who's a famous semiotician, which is the study of signs and symbols. And you find out that, you know, the Pentagon and these intelligence agencies have actually studied these kinds of things in depth.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what I believed 10 years ago about the relationship between CIA and Hollywood, if you were to tell me nowadays what I would believe, I would say Future Jay is crazy. So get back in your time machine and go back to Crazy Land or something. But anyway, so yeah, I'm rambling here, but that's how I got started on it. And then after I did about 80 or 90 analyses, and I did some interviews, and Sean Stone had me on, and that got some pretty wide viewership. I got approached by the publisher, and they said, hey, you know, you got an interesting interview. Do you actually have a book? And I said, yeah, I could. But I didn't actually have a book, but I had
I can pull, you know,
a bunch of analyses. Quick. Yeah, I had a bunch of articles that I thought could go in a book. And I said, yeah, I think this could be a book. So that was a pretty tedious year and a half or so, 2-year process of, you know, putting it together and trying to tweak it and this and that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny you mentioned 2001, seeing it, not understanding what was going on. And that was kind of my experience, too.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing 2001 and I'm trying to think of there's a few other movies I seen in high school, and I couldn't understand them. I'm like, I don't know what's going on here. Like, why is all this stuff happening? And it wasn't until years later when I started, you know, studying various work like Bill Cooper and others of the 90s generation of conspiracy theorists that I started to think, oh, well, maybe there is more here. And then of course, now here we are, you know, 16 years later, and it's we have guys like you doing work that kind of breaks it down, and it makes it a little more clear. But what I always found interesting is how all these symbolisms carry on through a lot of different work. And I wonder, you know, like, is it the directors that know about this, or is it the producers, or is it the set designers? Like, who's coming up with these hidden imageries and undertones going on through the films?
Well, I would say that it's probably a coalescence of various factors. And so there's not like necessarily one big click that says, you know, what has to be in every single scene. Because you're going to have also people just on their own that are influenced through their particular tastes and so forth. And I would say now that the conspiracy as a pop culture topic has gotten so, so widespread that you you probably have a lot of people who do graphic design or who do the, you know, computer generated imagery or whatever that, you know, they might stick things in there just because they're influenced by it. And the, the same phenomena has happened in comic books. I have friends that, that draw comics and they talk about, you know, a lot of times they'll stick things in the background of the comic book on purpose. But you also have, but I don't think all of that's nefarious. But so you also have another level of this where there are private interests and there are government Pentagon interests, and they will pay and they will cajole or do whatever they need to do to get film to do what they want. And one of the ways they've done that that's pretty well known by now, I think, is the various liaison offices. And so if a Hollywood production company or movie company wants to do you know, something that's part of the U.S. military, if they want to film on an aircraft carrier or something like this, then that the Pentagon sort of makes a deal and says, okay, well, you know, we want to be presented in a certain positive way. And you saw a lot of this in the 80s with sort of the Reagan era movies like Navy SEALs or Top Gun, and these were Iron Eagle. These were military recruitment type films. And there have actually been academic books written on this. Trisha Jenkins' book, CIA in Hollywood, and there's another book called Operation Hollywood. And these are by academics who have looked at the relationship between the Pentagon and CIA in Hollywood. And you've got actual CIA case officers who then go directly into working in Hollywood, such as Milt Bearden or Chase Brandon or Melissa Mela. These are all people from CIA operations who then literally consult and I would say in some cases handle people in films, especially with Melissa Maley's relationship to Angelina Jolie. So, so that's why you see connections with Hollywood and even agencies above the CFR, or above the CIA, like the CFR, right? So George Clooney and Angelina Jolie are members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And so, you know, once you get to that level of Hollywood stardom, people realize, I think probably through their experience, how the world really works, and they, you know, they want to move up the chain. And so they get into doing that kind of stuff. So I would say that to really, the people that really understand how it's going on and how it works are the A-list people, you know, the Leonardo DiCaprio types or the Ben Affleck types or Clooney or Jolie. You know, it's not your independent filmmaker. It's not, and you know, who knows to what degree Kubrick actually knew, you know, what was happening. There is evidence that he did meet with and work with people from NASA, that he did, you know, have these meetings with people from the Air Force and possibly the CIA as well, very likely. But I don't know for 100% positive on that. But the films are definitely, you know, from the film from the get-go has been used by the military as for propaganda. So, so there's not an easy answer to your question, but I would just say that it's a, you know, a combination of factors that drives people with various motives, you know, to put various symbols in. And sometimes it is 100% totally done for an occult agenda or for a sort of a government propaganda agenda. Like the movie Argo, it's a, that's a total sort of CIA creation. And, you know, Ben Affleck's very open about that.
Yeah, and aren't a lot of these A-listers, they're, you know, you go through their histories and they have ties to military intelligence and right. CIA. I'm thinking Jim Morrison and his father being, you know, naval security. So,
yeah, Gulf of Tonkin, right? Admiral Morrison,
Yeah, and it used to make me wonder, you know, like when I went to I went to college, but when I went to college, I studied 3D animation and filmmaking. And, you know, it's allowed me to meet some really interesting people and kind of sort of skirt on the outside of the industry. But some conversations I've had, you know, of like, I said one time to a friend of mine who his father was, you know, relatively well off. I'm sure he's very connected, and he was on his way to Hollywood. And I said, oh man, I should go with you. I want to go, you know, get into the industry and start working down there. And he just kind of looked at me and he's like, you're not the right type of person or something. And at the time I was kind of, you know, taken back by it. Didn't really know what he meant. Like, were you saying I wasn't talented enough, or I'm not good enough? And, now looking at the position that he's in, I'm like, oh, I wasn't of the right family. You know, like I didn't have the right connections. My parents weren't, you know, military intelligence or whatever. So, it's kind of interesting to see how the magicians of Hollywood are, you know, constantly scripting our narrative, and people are always falling into it.
Yeah, there's a lot of examples of weird family. Well, people talk about Hollywood royalty, so, you know, that's a very real thing. And I'm not any kind of insider. Well, it's kind of ironic that I was talking to Sean Stone about this, because he wrote a book about geopolitics and the British Empire and the New World Order. And, you know, he's from Hollywood and he's writing this geopolitics book, and I'm not from Hollywood. And I did my thesis on geopolitics and I wrote a book on Hollywood. So it was like totally backwards. You would think it would be the other way around, but, Laura Dern, for example, I always get this mixed up. Like, her great grandfather was the Secretary of Defense. But of course, Bruce Dern was a famous actor, and then that's her dad. And so Bruce Dern's granddad was this famous Secretary of Defense guy. And then I want to say he was Skull and Bones too, but I'm not 100% positive on that. But yeah, that's a connection that Dave McGowan goes into. And you can't always say that just because somebody had like a military intelligence relative. I know you guys are not saying that, but.
No.
Sometimes people, you know, people researching it will say, oh, well, here's some, his dad was in the Navy. Look at this. Well, my dad was in the Navy. And what does that mean exactly? Well, there's like tens of thousands of people in the Navy, right?
Mm-hmm.
My dad was enlisted. He wasn't even an officer. So some guy one time tried to point that out, like, his dad's in the Navy. And then there's this one guy, this is a funny story. He was trying to expose me as like this Hollywood phony guy. And so he had found this on IMDb. There's a Jay Dyer. And what's funny is that if you go and look at this guy, this Jay Dyer is actually like a 40-year-old black guy. No, actually, he's probably 50, right? Because he was producing black sitcoms when I would have been about 21. And so there was this dude on the internet one time, it was actually pretty well read. He's a published author. He was trying to expose me. He wrote this big expose and he was talking about how he found me on IMDb. And that was his game. I was like, so what's more likely, dude, that's a different person, or that when I was about 20 years old, I was producing black sitcoms in the 90s? Like, what's more likely there, right? Anyway, so I'm just saying that, you know, sometimes there's circumstantial evidence that because a person's family member. And that's why in my book, I do point out connections, but I also try to be reserved in, I'm not saying Dave McGowan wasn't, I think his book's great, you know, cause he just kind of throws these possibilities out there, and I'm reserved, you know, in my approach to, oh, well, this guy, you know, went and hung out with this person, and so that must mean this. But you're absolutely right. You will find very bizarre family connections at times, which I would just say are pieces of evidence. You know what I mean? They can point in that direction, but they don't always necessarily have to be, because if you're from America, well, your granddaddy was probably a Mason or was probably in some capacity in the military.
Mm-hmm.
It's just obvious.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's probably off topic. I'm rambling, but
no.
We were talking about military intelligence. Yeah. So, there's so many of these, man. I remember so many examples of this. This isn't new either, which is weird. You go back to the earliest days of acting, and a lot of people would be recruited into intelligence work or into spying, espionage, because they had good skill at acting, right? And this goes all the way back to Shakespeare and the Globe Theater. And a lot of those people back then were spies who were also actors. and it's because they're good con men. They can pull off playing somebody different, playing a different role, and that's why they're good at that trade or tradecraft. So, that's gone on for a long time, and then you can get into a lot of these people in the history of Hollywood who actually were. Some cases there's documented evidence, and then another, like Mo Berg, the pitcher, for example. Like, it's not just this applies to the music industry, and it applies to sports as well, professional mm-hmm. sports, which I don't really go into that much. But Mo Berg, for example, the pitcher, or excuse me, catcher, he worked for, he was a spy, I believe, for the Bureau of Investigation. I think it was before it was called the FBI. Jimmy Stewart, Cary Grant, Errol Flynn, all these people from old school Hollywood, silver screen era. And a lot of these people are believed to or documented to have been spies. And then, you watch a movie like The FBI Story with Jimmy Stewart, and you've got J. Edgar Hoover actually giving the introduction to the movie. Then it's like, oh, yeah, well, so it's actually not very hard to believe that Jimmy Stewart, was in some capacity working with the FBI. And then, like Dave McGowan points out in his book, you've got Lookout Mountain Studio, which was accessed by all of these top Hollywood people. Walt Disney had access to the Lookout Mountain Studios, which was the private Air Force studio up on Lookout Mountain down Mulholland Drive.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. I remember hearing a story too about, Monty Hall, being a CIA assassin and, mm-hmm. these other, a lot of it's rumors and speculation, but one thing you didn't mention too is the IMDb.
Well,
sorry.
Did you mean Chuck Barris or also Monty Hall?
I'm pretty sure it was Monty Hall. It might have been Chuck Barris too. I'd actually have to go back and look at that. It's been a few years.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to say about the IMDb thing. I found it interesting. Of course, we'll probably get into it here later in the interview, but Pizzagate's been going on and everybody in the alternative media is talking about it. And we had a guy go into Comet Pizza Ping Pong or whatever the place is called and brandish an assault rifle the other day. And now I see a lot of posts going up about him having an IMDb page. And I found it funny because I have an IMDb page. I don't. Like anybody can have an IMDb page. So mm-hmm. I get a little leery when I start seeing these, reports of crisis actors and stuff. Like I know they do use crisis actors. I've seen it employed mm-hmm. myself. So, it's possible he's a crisis actor, but having an IMDb page doesn't really make it 100% or anything.
No, I agree. And it's just like the case of family members being military intelligence or something. That's a piece of evidence that could point in a certain direction, or it could be purely circumstantial, coincidental. But it just depends. I mean, I agree, right? So like in the case of Omar Mateen at the Orlando shooting, now he has an IMDb page. Now, if that alone were if that was it, I would agree that would not be that big of a deal. But when you look at the fact that his company that he worked for, G4S Security, is also contracted with this company,
mm-hmm.
called Crisis Cast, that makes you sign a non-disclosure agreement, I think that begins to mount evidence to point in a certain direction. Now, is that 100% proof? No, and that's why there's a whole bunch of other data points that, really give us a better thesis on understanding what's happening, I would say, than the mainstream picture or the MK Ultra Mind Control Assassin thesis. I don't think that's a very coherent thesis, I think. It's kind of like 9/11. If you get lost in trying to debate temperatures of jet fuel or something like that, I don't think any of those points on their own is going to show or prove anything. And that's why you really have to have a bigger scope, a bigger picture look to have the big, third eye view, not third eye view. What am I? God's eye. Wow. God's eye view, right? Like
you're going to have the trolls just hopping with this one.
Now, what I'm talking about is the bigger vantage point. Okay, so if you do analysis or like an intelligence analysis, there's kind of the more analytical on the ground inductive approach where you're putting together the pieces like an investigator would do in a crime scene or a detective or something. But there's also a different kind of analysis that should ideally work together with the first, which is the big scale picture. So, for example, how are you going to understand 9/11 if you're not aware of neoconservative approaches to foreign policy? I don't think you really can, because it's a key fixture, according to the Project for a New American Century, in reinvigorating this idea of the American century, right? That Americanism needed to be rebooted through some kind of giant terror event that was like Pearl Harbor. You see, that's a key piece of the picture, mm-hmm. the narrative, that you're not going to get if you just look at the architects and engineers type approach, where you're only concerned with, you know, the rate of speed at which a building falls. And I'm not saying those things don't matter. I'm just saying you're basically just doing this sort of masturbatory engineering circle jerk that nobody else knows what you're talking about, when the whole point of the operation was to alter the landscape of American surveillance of the population and foreign policy, which is what the documents, I mean, in other words, that should be a key piece of evidence, is the PNAC talking about what they wanted to do prior to 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember when that document
came out. I'm not saying that they don't talk, right? I'm not saying they don't ever talk about it. I'm just saying there's a hyper inductive approach that is obsessed over that. You're not ever going to prove or disprove things by getting lost in minutiae, is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with any of these things that everybody looks into. Pizzagate, the big story is actually, should be, I would say, the Clinton Foundation. Uh-huh. It's not these outlet characters, because if you look at all these different instances of the cases that come out of Saville, of the Franklin cover-up, Sandusky, you know, all the government in Australia, people that were involved in pedophilia, and on and on and on. These, it's like drugs. It's like the drug running. It's like, so what if some lower level cartel is busted somewhere? The institution is just going to continue. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Well, that's
until you go after the things that are really running it. And now how that's done, I don't know how you go after the Clinton Foundation.
Well, I don't know if you really can, but that's an interesting point, is that, you know, we tend to, as conspiracy theorists, that's what I consider myself anyway, we get bogged down with these little details and, you know, focusing in on, okay, was it, you know, hot dog, does that mean underage boy or whatever, you know, and we failed to look at the bigger picture of, hey, look, the Clinton Foundation was caught, you know, doing all kinds of horrible things in Haiti. We had people that were caught red-handed stealing kids coming mm-hmm. out of Haiti. You know, there was the reports years ago of I think it was DynCorp, or what, it was a bit one of the big corporations having, you know, plane loads of children right. from these third world countries being flown around the globe. So we've known, anybody that's been doing this for quite some time is knowing that this has been going on, and there's been plenty of evidence come out over the years of what was going on. But now we're bogged down with this Pizzagate, and everybody's focused in on these two pizza joints in DC that maybe they're involved, maybe they're not involved. What, you know, it doesn't really matter. Even if they do hang those guys out to dry, if they hung Podesta out to dry, it isn't going to change anything. It's still going to continue going on.
Right. Exactly. And it also has, I've done some, you know, looking into WikiLeaks and analysis of WikiLeaks over the last few years. And you have to always, whenever there's a giant leak, you always have to wonder about the timing, and you have to mm-hmm. wonder about, like, why the leaks are let out. Now, that doesn't mean that everything in the leak is fake or false or made up. It just means that there can be ulterior motives for why a leak happens. And if you, great example of this is if you look at the I write for 21stCenturyWire.com. We're run by Patrick Henningsen. If you look at the articles at 21 Wire that were done some months ago about the Panama leak, Panama Papers leaks or whatever, this was this obviously targeted leak. And when you look into the background, this is like Soros-connected foundations are you know, leaking this information, and it's only targeted in this case at Putin. Now maybe there is corruption going on like this, but the question is, why is this leak only targeted at Putin? So we know from the Franklin cover-up that the situation like Pizzagate is not partisan. It's not just Democratic people. It's bipartisan corruption. I mean, how many of the Republicans have been caught, you know, touching interns and their young boys and this kind of stuff too, mm-hmm. right? The Franklin cover-up was connected to GOP. So it's not partisan. It's not like, oh, those rat bastard Democrats are, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
They're eating little babies. you know, maybe in this case, these Democrats were, you know, that degenerate or something, but regardless, that kind of corruption could never be purely partisan. And that's why you see it being global.
Well, yeah, that's another interesting thing too. Like, I mean, everybody was so quick to point at the Democrats and blame them for this whole Pizzagate thing when Donald Trump was on a plane with Jeffrey Epstein flying around to mm-hmm. the Lolita Express, right? Now,
well, I'm not a Trump apologist, just to be fair and to be clear, the supposed lawsuit that was leveled against Trump in relationship to this claim was dropped. So, mm-hmm. you know, to my knowledge, there's not any direct evidence of that Clinton did anything on Epstein's plane. There is evidence of Bill taking a whole bunch of trips. And of course, Epstein was convicted at one point. So, mm-hmm. you know, again, make of that what you will. But as I understand, the lawsuits against Trump in terms of raping a young girl or something have been dropped.
Yeah. No, the actual lawsuit, I was just referencing the fact that he was actually, you know, hanging around with Jeffrey and called him a nice guy and stuff. Now, you're right. That doesn't mean that Trump is out abusing children. But it's another interesting connection. I mean, here we have Jeffrey Epstein connected to Trump. We have him connected to the Clintons. We have him connected to Prince Andrew of the royal family, you know, visiting his island there. What did they call it? The Villa de Bang Bang in the French Riviera. Yeah. You know, like.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just saying you have to be careful with, like we were saying, with military intelligence. I mean, you know, you can't fallacy. I'm not saying you're doing this. I'm just saying one of the dangers I see about the people looking into Pizzagate is a fallacy of association. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
I'm sure I've been photographed with maybe alternative media characters or something that somebody could say. I remember one time somebody said on my blog, they said, I saw you at Bilderberg with Alex Jones. You're a shill. And I was like, well, I've never been to Bilderberg, right? And I've never been in any kind of photo or anything like that with Alex Jones. But what I'm saying is that somebody might theorize that because I was in, and I mean, if you're at the billionaire class of people or government higher ups, you're going to be constantly around people. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
well,
but you're right
too,
that it, yeah, go ahead.
I just wonder, you know, like I know from personal experience and like I mentioned at the first of the show about going to Hollywood, in order to get to the levels of Donald Trump or, you know, even a Clinton, you have to make compromises. You have to be willing to work with people and ignore some of their failings, I guess. And that's what makes me wonder about a lot of these higher echelon people in this show we're being blasted into our retinas from the TV about, you know, Trump versus Hillary or whatever. And it's all one big club, in my opinion, you know, like they all seem to hang out together. They all seem to work together. And at some point they had to know. I mean, it was like, I guess, shit, I can't think of his name now. Corey Feldman, you know, when he came out and said, you know, everybody in Hollywood's full of pedophiles. And then, you know, we knew that.
Yeah, and you've got Elijah Wood, you know, saying the same thing, and a lot of other people have said that over the years too. Mackenzie Phillips and people like this, mm-hmm. you know, from Mamas and Papas, and so, yeah. I mean, what do you do with that? I'm not sure. I mean, I think that we are people are starting to wake up. I mean, I do think that is true. But is that enough? You know what I mean? Like, in my view, what I try to do is kind of ground people in a wider worldview. And that involves philosophy and, in my view, some religious beliefs. Because I think that if you just present people a bunch of facts, or say with Pizzagate, if you've already demoralized a population and brainwashed them to a certain level to where they don't even have like a moral compass or benchmark in any sense, pretty much, then all releasing this kind of stuff does is further traumatize or further desensitize. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying that people shouldn't look into Pizzagate. All I'm saying is that, or that it shouldn't be talked about or looked at or something like that. But I'm saying that you have to be leery of the fact that the establishment knows how to use media to lead people down false leads, false trails, and into deception down the road. Now, that doesn't mean that Pizzagate's not true, but what I'm saying is, we're going to be told, and this is something that we've been dealing with at my website lately and at 21st Century Wire, is that we've been told that there's all these fake news stories now, and what Facebook and Google are going to have to do is to curate this news. Obama's talked about it in several speeches. He's going to have to work with Facebook and Google to filter out unapproved news sites. And one of the sites that I write for was listed at the top of that list. Mm-hmm. So this affects me directly. I'm not dependent on Facebook, but the reality of the modern world is that a lot of people a lot of internet traffic now is directed through Facebook. So if Facebook, says Jay's Analysis is a, fake news site, or 21 Wire is a fake news site, or, you guys are a fake news site, that's going to affect your traffic.
Oh yeah, for sure.
That's obviously censorship to a degree that is just sort of unbelievable, really.
Well, that's like, what's going on with advertisers, where we run the conspiracy channel. It's a smart TV network. We're on, 500,000 devices. And when we approached advertisers, we're like, look, we're getting, 500,000 views per month. This is great traffic for people that, for advertisers to get in on. And every last one of them said no. We approached every big advertising company out there that does video ads on the internet, and every last one of them said no. And then that's kind of left us in a lurch, and now we have a problem with the little bit of money we do have coming in through YouTube is now constantly going down every month, as they're flagging our videos as not being advertiser friendly. And
I get that too. I get that constantly, because my YouTube videos are monetized, and it has, gotten to become a thing where it pays the rent. So it matters to me when they demonetize videos.
Well, that's just it. Like our revenues went down a third or two thirds, 6 months ago, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And that's what it was, is they had demonetized about half of our videos. And some of them that they demonetized, like we had a guy on that wrote a book about human trafficking in Southeast Asia. And it wasn't, there was no conspiracy theory there. It was just his story of being almost abducted by human traffickers. And they demonetized that one. And I was like, well, where's the line? What are you guys doing? And then, of course, now we've got the fake news narrative going on. And it seems like Pizzagate's kind of conveniently popped up at the right time.
Yes, it has. Yeah.
And it's become
this
a focus.
Is what we were talking. Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, go ahead, Jay.
Sorry, I was just agreeing. I didn't mean to cut you off. I was on a couple podcasts the past week, and that's kind of we were kicking around ideas and brainstorming, and that's pretty much what we had come to. Patrick Henningsen said the same thing as well, that Pizzagate comes at a time when right in the midst of this other thing on the other hand is fake news, and who's going to save us from the fake news? Of course, mainstream media is the biggest purveyor of fake news on the planet. They've been caught countless times. I mean, so this is like Satan's going to guard us from Lucifer or something. But I think that it's very possible, that Pizzagate served a dual function or a multi-function. On the one hand, being a partisan leak to damage Hillary's campaign because they thought, you know, maybe Hillary's not our best choice. Maybe she's not in good health. Maybe she's too corrupt. You know, we got to have somebody else, which I'm not necessarily 100% convinced that Trump is, you know, fully part of the establishment of the system per se. I mean, I'm just reserving judgment. I'm not making a decision. I think we'll know, within months, mm-hmm. what that is particularly relating to the appointment, you know, who he appoints and this kind of stuff is, I think, will be very telling, and whether it was all campaign rhetoric or what exactly is going on with the Trump thing. Was it just theater and pageantry or what? But I think that we are, our noses are sniffing in the right direction to consider that Pizzagate is probably time released also in relation to fake news, because if you recall, they were saying, oh, Donald Trump got elected because of fake news.
Yeah.
What, literally saying this, which is utterly ridiculous. I think these things are probably all connected. You're right.
Well, I know, you know, like I'm a big student of Bill Cooper, and I guess that kind of gives me a hesitation for when any of this stuff comes up that, you know, we might not actually see what's going on behind the scenes and why we're being pointed in those directions. I mean, it was like Jay-Z running around throwing the triangle up all the time. It was kind of like, you know, okay, well, maybe he is Illuminati or, you know, some secret cult, but chances are he's just using it as a symbol because he knows it's going to get a lot of internet rumor going around, and that's going to increase his album sales, etc. So we always have to be very leery of such things, especially when we're dealing with Hollywood, who, I mean, they're the masters of fiction. So we should be really careful when anything comes out of the mainstream media or you know, is pointed to by the mainstream media as some sort of conspiracy theory, because that just eggs us on to investigate it more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the establishment loves conspiracy theories. Now, I'm not saying that everybody who's a conspiracy theorist is part of the establishment, but I'm just saying that the government and spies love conspiracy theories because they can be useful. For example, if let's just say a rival government or a rival power structure wants to destabilize someone else, well, what they might do is promote, say, conspiracy theories in that culture or society about a leader. We see this about Putin, all right? That Putin's doing this. Saddam's throwing babies out of incubators, right? This is ridiculous sort of conspiracy theory on the part of George W. Bush concocted by a PR company. Mm-hmm. Right, so that's an example of quote conspiracy theory being used as a psychological warfare tool to, you know, target, well, in that case I would say the Western global population, but you could also have conspiracy theories propagated by, for example, a lot of times you'll get Arab countries will promote these Zionist conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that there's no powerful Jews or that there's no Zionist lobby, but what I'm saying is that you will have Arab nations that, for their interests, will promote that conspiracy theory. Doesn't mean that there's no sense in which, you know, there's corrupt people in Israel. Doesn't mean that everybody in those Arab countries is bad, right? So it's just not, the real world's not that simple. It's not, you know, all or nothing situation.
Well, that's what RT does, right? Like they constantly promote people that are considered conspiracy theorists by our mainstream media. And you know, when something bad comes up with Putin, we saw this with Abby Martin, you know, that then they get a little bit more hesitant on publishing it, but they're more than happy to publish any conspiracy theory relating to Western governments.
Well, they are overall, though, I would say they're better than Western. In other words, while it is a state-run institution, you'll notice that they do a lot better than in telling the truth overall, I think, than our media. Our media is like the worst thing on the planet. And our media is, if you look at like CNN, while their ratings might be dropping domestically, CNN Global is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a giant CIA propaganda matrix that I think is just unbelievable, you know, how much global influence that they have. So, you know, I welcome the idea of competitors to the monopoly. And, you know, even despite the flaws of those competitors, I think. You
know, well, yeah, like I don't really have a problem so much with RT. I mean, I look at them and I kind of think, well, okay, you're a Russian propagated news service. So obviously there's going to be a bit of a Russian slant and perhaps you're mm-hmm. going to, you know, have on people that the Western media wouldn't talk to. And in a lot of cases, those people have some really good points. I mean, you know, like Wayne Madison and these guys like that would never get airplay on CNN are getting a ton of airplay yeah. on RT. And it is helpful. You know, and we see our government doing the same thing. Like it's like here in Canada. I mean, you watch the Canadian media and they don't really ever talk too much about the power structure here in Canada, but you watch perhaps CNN will do some really good exposés on Canadian issues. So it's kind of a give and take.
Yeah. This is kind of an old trick where you'll have, like 60 Minutes in Australia did a report on the pedophile networks in London in the mm-hmm. UK. Yeah. But 60 Minutes Australia is probably not going to do an investigation into Australia's pedophiles, right?
No, most likely not.
Well, they won't talk about the fact that, you know, massive amounts of Aboriginal people in Australia were, you know, taken away from their families and sexually abused mm-hmm. by the power structure.
Oh, that's
themselves.
A great point. Yeah, it's a great point.
Well, it's the same here in Canada. I mean, they'll get on, you know, CBC and they'll talk about the residential schools and how these kids were taken away from their parents, but they never talk about the, you know, the 50,000 kids that disappeared or yeah. the reports of the royal family taking native kids back to England that have never been mm-hmm. seen again, you know, like all these little things that should be pretty big stories. I mean, they just don't get covered.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things I try to talk about in my book is the way that the mainstream media is tied to Hollywood and what it functions to do, that sort of marriage there, I call it a dark marriage, a dark occult marriage. What it functions to do is to fill in the narratives, right? And this is a great point that my friend Chris over at Hoaxbusters made, was that you'll get these, if we have an event like 9/11 or something like that, you'll have people kind of picking up the details here and there from the mainstream media. But because mainstream news and media is not the most interesting thing out there, what people really go to get their view of an event is Hollywood. So the movies that you've seen about quote terrorists or terrorist events and all this stuff is going to be a lot more influential on your perspective, and it's going to pull on your heartstrings and it's going to use emotion, and it's going to formulate your worldview in a much more powerful way than, you know, Tom Brokaw, boring voice, monotone reading, you know, about bin Laden and the towers or something like this, you mm-hmm. see? And so Hollywood functions to fill in the gaps, to tell you the story that you think the mainstream news is there to give you. And mm-hmm. what better example than the most recent CIA military Pentagon films like Zero Dark Thirty or American Sniper, right? Mm-hmm. These are kind of continuations of that Argo style, you know, this new totally propaganda created, totally intelligence Pentagon created movies right hand in hand with Hollywood. I couldn't think of better examples than that.
Yeah, those are two really good examples of Hollywood's, you know, spinning of events, and it's always interesting. It's like,
but they're made in tandem directly with CIA and Pentagon people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly, exactly. Well, and that makes sense, right? Like you have to have the narrative, play your story. So, you know, you put the facts in the movie and then you spin the narrative to come out how you want it to in the end, right? Like, you know, the Iran-Contra affair, like they totally spun Argo to be, you know,
something,
a good thing for the Americans to have done. But in reality, it really wasn't. I guess it's the same with, you know, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Like there was a lot of spin that came out years afterwards about that.
Well, the irony about Argo, that one of the things I think is funny about it is that the storyline itself is that the cover that the CIA is going to use is filming of a bad movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
The filming of a bad movie covers for the operation. Mm-hmm. Now, the funny thing is that in reality, that's what Argo is.
Yeah, exactly.
You follow me? Yeah. Argo is the cover for the CIA disinfo operation that is the rescuing of these people from the embassy as an October surprise, against the Carter administration or whatever, which I'm not sure I totally buy that, because the Carter administration, you know, the Reagan administration and the Carter administration, they might have on the face been at odds regarding the policy towards the Iran and the Ayatollahs. But I'm sorry, if you read a good bit about Iran and its history and intelligence operations in the last several decades, you'll have Norman Schwarzkopf's dad trained the SAVAK. Mm-hmm. Now, what is Norman Schwarzkopf's dad, who was another, like a colonel or general or something, he's training the Iranian Secret Service?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and this is supposed to be in the period, right, when, after the Shah is gone, you get this guy called the Ayatollah Kashani, and this is supposed to be a virulently anti-American Ayatollah, right?
Mm-hmm.
But all of the SAVAK, which is the Secret Intelligence Service of Iran, they were all straight out of CIA and MI6. These are all CIA MI6 trained guys. So you have no change in the personnel, they just changed their name.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all detailed in, I believe, Robert Dreyfuss's book, Devil's Game. And so you read a lot, you know, you start picking up on these little details like this, and it's like, well, wait a minute. So we're still, throughout that whole period is what I'm trying to say, that Western intelligence was secretly, you know, kind of dealing in the background with these Ayatollahs who are supposedly, you know, they hate America and all this stuff. Which, you know, I'm dubious.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like like how these Western or these little dictators like Kim Jong-un trained in Western civilization or in Western universities, right? Like, and you look, and that's not just him; it's almost all of them. All their kids go to, you know, Western-based schools. They're going to London, they're going to New York, whatever, and they're living there, and nobody seems to know about it. And then, you know, flash 10 years, and they're the dictator of their country.
Yeah, he goes to a Swiss boarding school that a lot of CIA kids go to, right? Children of CIA people go to the Swiss boarding school. Oh, it just happens to be where Kim Jong-un is at. And, maybe that's just because it's prestigious or something like this. Or no, I mean, if that was the only thing, then great point. As we said before, that would be merely circumstantial. But when we look at the whole apparatus of what North Korea is supposed to be and what it's presented as, I view it very similar to Castro's Cuba. You have all these pieces of evidence, all these bizarre oddities that you can't explain by this traditional, you know, good guy, bad guy dialectic, you know, good mm-hmm. East, bad West, good capitalist, bad commie. None of this makes sense in either of these cases of the boogeyman, just like with bin Laden. So I view Kim Jong-un and Ill, just like Castro, just like bin Laden, theses make a lot more sense to me, even though I guess it could be called feces.
Yeah, well, it should be called feces. Yeah, no, I found that interesting. I seen you posted something about the Castro having, you know, been involved in movies and working in Hollywood prior to him becoming this revolutionary in Cuba.
Exactly.
You know, like obviously they're controlling, and we know they're doing this. We know they're going in and utilizing regime change and whatnot. So why wouldn't they be putting, you know, we know they put in their own puppets. So why wouldn't some of these guys have trained in the U.S. and been set up by the CIA to become these, you know, fantastical dictators that everybody fears?
Yeah.
But you've always got to have an enemy when you're running a military industrial complex.
And you also can start to pick up that the boogeyman bad guys appear at strategic locations in certain continents and in certain regions. So Castro, according to the really, really excellent analysis of Servando Gonzalez's book, Psychological Warfare in the New World Order, he's analyzed Castro his whole life, and he's really proposed this thesis and documented it well, I think. He says, look, if you go back to the beginning of Castro's political life, when he was 21 or 22, and this is actually on the CIA website, declassified, he was at the Colombian Bogotazo riots provocateuring. And what happens there? Well, they get rid of the guy who, Gaitán, who's going to be the, you know, nationalize the resources and all that. And this overthrow just happens to benefit the CIA in that region. And this kicks off the Cold War in Central and Latin America. So there's Castro playing a central boogeyman role for CIA operations there. You have the same pattern, I would say, with North Korea and that region. This kicks off a new boogeyman there. You've got various other tin pot dictators you could point out all over the place, like you're saying, right? I mean, there's a whole bunch of examples of this, and I list that in the video that I did about Castro. And you'll notice that same pattern with a lot of these characters. Same patterns in the Middle East, right? You get these threatening dictators and monarchs or whatever, and you know they have these really shady backgrounds. And what does Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan come out and say? Oh yeah, the CIA runs the drug trade in Afghanistan. Well, duh. I mean, there's like Beraldo's going and interviewing the troops while they're sitting there guarding the opium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's just it. It's all a show. It is. Every last little aspect of what we think of as modern civilization, or at least modern, I don't know.
I don't want to say, see, yes.
You know what I mean, though. But it's all been set up. It every last little aspect of it seems to be this narrative that we play by. I mean, it's like here in Canada, we elected, you know, social justice warrior extreme here, Justin Trudeau, and he's selling weapons to the Saudi regime, you know, and
yeah.
You know,
yeah,
real hardcore weapons. I mean, here in Canada, you know, everybody thinks of Canadians as these sleepy little people in the north. They say sorry too much. We're so polite, but they don't ever investigate the fact that, you know, all the United States smart bombs, most of the guidance systems are made in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
All the biological warfare that research that's been going on, a lot of it's done here in Canada.
Yeah.
You know, we
hold up, Rob.
Okay.
This is Barack Obama, Barack H. Obama.
Oh no.
Now listen, Rob, I understand. I understand you feel cheated. Okay. But the real deal here is we've got to have sensible gun control here domestically. But I'm gonna run guns down to Mexico. Okay? now you might think that's a contradiction, but Rob, I assure you it's not. Now I studied constitutional law, and it's constitutional. I just had to break into
your Obama's spot on. Spot on. I love it.
It comes and goes. Sometimes it's better than other times. I don't know, but you got to get that. He's got a really little. He's got these little inflections he does, kind of at the ends of words. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it depends on what audience he's in front of, right? If he's talking to a black audience, he's a little more. He's got a little more soul, you know. But if he's talking to a white audience, it's a little more clarified, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Now I've lost my train of thought. Oh, I you know what?
But you know what? What I wrote about in the book is that point that you were making, right? That that it's all kind of theater. And that's what I noticed. I was like, man, you know what? Hollywood has had so much of an influence. Like, there's probably just no way to calculate it because it's global. Hollywood's not just America. Hollywood is, you know, people in Pakistan watch James Bond mm-hmm. movies. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not 100% positive this is true, but when I was doing research into Bond, I remember reading that the Egyptian intelligence services, they have used Ian Fleming's novels in their training and research.
Now I'm not surprised.
I'm not saying that they do that because like all the Egyptian agents are going to try to be James Bond. No, what it means is that they are looking at understanding spy culture through mm-hmm. the lens of Ian Fleming. And just take spy culture, like that alone is something that Hollywood and fiction writers basically brought into reality that you never had prior to probably World War I.
Mm-hmm.
After World War I, British fiction writers, spy writers really start churning out these novels, you know, this really creates a culture, and then Hollywood picks up on it, and that's what makes James Bond, up until Harry Potter, the biggest franchise in world history, and it's global. So this is just incalculable influence through this medium of Hollywood movies. And that was the main reason I wrote the book, is that the more that I looked into these things, and you just you don't even realize it, like product placement, that begins with James Bond, with Bond, you know, having certain drinks and vodka, and Sean Connery promoting certain watches, and you know, the Aston Martin and the Walter PPK mm-hmm. and all this stuff.
That's interesting. I never really noticed that part about the product placement starting there. I know I see product placement everywhere.
It begins with Bond, according to my research.
That wouldn't surprise me. I know, like here in Canada, our intelligence service, like even when I was going to college in the 90s, there was no official intelligence service for Canada, though we've had one mm-hmm. since World War II, called CSIS. Yeah. And then we found out that there's actually like three different intelligence agencies working in Canada. And the other two we're not really supposed to know very much about. Even CSIS, we don't really know what they do. They won't tell us anything. And the only thing we know seemed to all come out after a lot of the big spy movies started happening. And then mm-hmm. you know, it slowly leaked out. Oh, wait, well, yeah, we do have a spy agency, but we don't really do much. So even though I was told, like when I was doing my first year in college, I was doing application programming, and my instructor told us about Echelon then. Mm-hmm. That was 94, 95, and explained to us how it worked, what they were doing with it, how every email, phone conversation, fax was all being recorded. There was a big data dump of it. And it was another 15 years before it actually became public. So I think a lot of this stuff is dropped into movies and dropped into pop culture so that when it is exposed, we're like, oh, that was just in that movie 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's probably a couple chapters in my book where I deal with that notion and, you know, what is predictive programming. And I think it is kind of a conditioning technique mainly. That's the most useful aspect to what the internet has donned predictive programming. Or Alan Watt or whoever, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to give people credit or they'll get mad, right?
Yeah, well,
hi, folks. I am Alan Watt.
I once saw a woman float down the stairs.
anyway, so what were we talking about? It's conditioning. And the most of the conditioning, I would say, now is focused on the sci-fi type stuff
mm-hmm.
where the... You I've consistently seen this pattern of the AI bots being presented as having more humanity than humans. This is like constant. And this is the whole theme of Westworld, which is, you know, everybody's watching Westworld now. The whole point of it is that all the humans are these nasty, brutish, vile creatures, and the bots are all noble and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I just think that this is the next phase of you know, conditioning people. I don't believe that bots are going to be conscious and, you know, coming to life or anything as ridiculous as that. But I think they're going to use it as a means to dehumanize humans and to further destroy the notion of what a human person is and human rights and so forth. Although I don't mean that in the traditional Enlightenment sense of human rights. I mean it in the more classic religious notion of what a human person is. So what the establishment wants to do is through all this transgender stuff and through all the transhumanist stuff is take it to the next phase, the next stage where just like there's 60 or 70 genders supposedly in different places like Germany or something, they're going to start saying that what it means to be a person is also a limitation and that you can't claim any special status, right? It'll be called human privilege, right? Oh, that instead of white privilege or something, it'll be human privilege. And who are you to speak evil of the bots or the androids or the cyborgs or the, you know, people with the robot hands or something like this, or the guy who's married to his sex bot, like who are you to say that that's not marriage? And this is all just total mind control.
Well, it's really breaking down the fabric of civilization and human contact, really. Like I watched the season finale of Westworld last night, and at the end of it, I was like, well, holy shit, this is like the transhumanist agenda, like told in full, right? Like you might as well had Anthony Hopkins be played by Ray Kurzweil, you know?
It was
I don't want to say too much because I'm sure this will be up before some people have seen it, so I don't want to give any spoilers out, but yeah, you should watch the last episode for sure. One thing you mentioned, and I guess we'll probably just wrap up on this one, but Harry Potter. Now, Harry Potter has been just marketed to hell everywhere you turn, even now after it's been out for how many years, and now we have the new film Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. What was your analysis of the Harry Potter world? Like, why is that one so popular?
Well, I think a lot of these kind of basic stories about I know you guys know what archetypes is, but in literature you also have archetypal stories, right? So you have like the dark hero story, or you've got the coming of age story, or you've got the, you know, classical space opera style story of Star Wars or something like this. So I think any of the stories that try to utilize archetypal narratives have the potential to be, you know, as big as Harry Potter or Star Wars or something like this, good guy versus bad guy. And it's a, you know, cosmic battle. So the reason Harry Potter is so popular is that it utilizes that, but it also is, I would say, connected to a larger plan to really infuse the culture with the occult. Now, I know that the occult means hidden, but what I'm saying is that if you go to bookstores, all of the young adult literature is either apocalypse or witches or zombies. That's all there is. And so I think that they're really trying to induct the next generations into quote alternative lifestyles, right? So you're being told that everything that you were, you know, everything that's supposed to be bad, right, is really just an alternative lifestyle, be it, you know, the way that you want to exemplify your gender or the religious views that you take or whatever. That was all formerly seen as bad, and now you're free from all that. You're free to choose whatever you want, and oh, look at all these sexy dark things like vampires and all this stuff. And really, it's just cultural programming. It's a way to, as you said, break down the fabric of society through very dangerous things. Now, obviously not everybody who watches Harry Potter is a witch or something like that, but it does provoke interest in things that can lead to something very dangerous. Now, does that mean that I'm saying I'm not like a Puritan or something like this? I mean, I think J.R.R. Tolkien's works are good, so I'm not saying that all usage in fiction of magic or something like that's evil, but it just depends on, you know, how it's presented and how it's done. And Harry Potter is probably promoted for that reason. When I look at J.K. Rowling, what her worldview is and what her perspective is, I mean, she pretty much lines up with this SJW type stuff. Mm-hmm. She promotes all the Western NATO. She's like promoting this fake stuff from Syria.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about that, right? It's like she tweets out the stuff about Syria that's in line with the CIA NATO narrative. So, you know, I've seen her having these weird connections to the Queen, J.K. Rowling, hanging out with royals. And then there's this backstory about her that she was supposedly the single mom and struggling. And, you know, maybe that's true, but maybe not. You know, maybe this is, it's all concocted for a reason. I'm not positive, but
well,
what I deal with in my book is basically, I don't Harry Potter, which I probably should, but, you know, maybe that'll be part two or something. But, you know, I tried to pick some of the big players, Hitchcock, Spielberg, Kubrick, and, you know, I was just kind of limited by space,
mm-hmm.
You know, but it may be in the next installment, you know, I'll go into maybe Star Wars and Lucas or Harry Potter or something like that.
Well, what I found interesting with the Harry Potter was even the occultic stuff. I agree with you. That seems to be a method of pushing it to the youth to be able to accept the fact that there will be occultic people, you know, practicing Luciferianism or you know, paganism or whatever. But what I found really interesting was how the class structure worked in Harry Potter, where you had the muggles who were, you know, the plebes that didn't really have a clue. And then you have this magical group that exists alongside of the muggles that they don't know about, this whole secret society of witches and warlocks that go to these special schools that, you know, they have their own special groups. They have their own special code words. They have their own special initiations and rituals. And that's
right.
That to me, it was kind of like it was predictive programming in the fact that as time goes on, we're starting to learn more about secret societies. Now, I mean, you know, 200 years ago, the Masons were truly a secret society. It could get you killed to talk about it. Whereas these days, almost everybody knows a Mason, you know? I just always found that part of it interesting and something I probably should actually do some research into.
One of the things I write about in my book is this notion of theater of cruelty and revelation of the method, right? And this is also from Michael Hoffman's books. And what you get with that is this idea that once you've debased the culture to a certain degree, you can go ahead and come out of the closet, so to speak, in terms of your occultic penchant or your sexual penchant or whatever it might be. And this is the whole idea of the externalization of the hierarchy that you get Annie Besant and Blavatsky talking about, is that once they had re-engineered society to a certain level, they could go ahead and be open about, you know, their formerly persecuted views, so-called. Mm-hmm. So, but the theater of cruelty idea is that you can traumatize people through mass media and through Hollywood and these different outlets. And I think that is part of its role, is to, you know, what in the conspiracy world we think about as MK Ultra or trauma-based mind control for some individual, I view it as ultimately being the attempt to do it on the mass mind, right? Mm-hmm. To traumatize the population as a whole, just to fracture their psyche through the mass media as a whole. And that's what a lot of this stuff is designed to do. And if you deconstruct it, I think it loses its power over you.
Yeah. I think once you can see through the veil, it makes it a little easier for you to deal with. Like, I know I don't watch movies quite in the same way I used to. I see, you know, the hidden symbology, I see the hidden narratives, and it doesn't have that effect on me, but we look at how TVs modulate at 60 hertz, how you know, they load us up with all these toxic chemicals like fluoride and whatnot and then set us in front of the TV. Well, that's, I mean, in the 60s they were doing that, giving guys LSD and setting them in front of visual images that traumatize them, right? So now we just have it on a mass scale.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, that's what Clockwork Orange shows. If you remember the scenes when they're forcing Alex to watch all these traumatic, you know, images on the screen. That's the effect it's having on him. It puts him into this catatonic state and just kind of makes him, you know, milquetoast pliant, right? Like he just sort of lays around and smiles and acts goofy. And the whole intention was to breed out of him his rebellious streak, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it works.
Yeah.
So here's Kubrick telling you that, you know, MK Ultra, which everybody thinks of as, you know, a spy being strapped down on a table and, you know, Scarlett Johansson's getting, you know, programming, putting into her head about who she's got to go kill or something. That's not really what it is. I mean, that might've happened at different times with testings and so forth, but what it really is was, you know, the ability to, you through technological devices, mm-hmm. beam this stuff out to the entire population and give them their worldview. And that's what Hollywood is. Hollywood is MK Ultra.
Yep.
Exactly. I think that pretty much sums it up perfectly. All right. Well, Jay Dyer, thank you very much for being here. And again, the
sure. Websites... Can I add?
Sure.
Can I add that if people want to get the book, mm-hmm. The best way to do it for me is to get it directly from me. Now, if you're outside the U.S., it's probably better to get it through Amazon because the shipping gets pricey. But if you want to get the book from me and it is a signed copy, there's a tab at my website to order it from me.
Awesome.
Yeah, and I highly recommend people go pick it up. Actually, I think when we're done recording here, I'll talk to you really quickly about getting me a copy. You can find all Jay's work at jaysanalysis.com and 21st Century Wire?
Yeah.
Yeah, I always just click the links on Facebook so I can never remember the domain name. And the great sites, great analysis. And Jay, it's been a real honor to talk to you. I really do enjoy your work. And I hope over the next few years, we can get together and do this a few more times because I think we're heading on some interesting conversations.
Absolutely. Anytime.
All right. Thanks a lot. And we'll be right back, folks. Okay, I hope you guys all really enjoyed that interview with Jay. He's a hell of a researcher, probably one of the best new faces we're seeing in the alternative media. So make sure to check out his website, jaysanalysis.com. And because it's Christmas time, we want to do a giveaway. So if you want a copy of Jay Dyer's book, Esoteric Hollywood, plus a one-year subscription to the Conspiracy Channel, all you have to do is create a meme. You know, those little funny pictures that everybody posts on Facebook with a funny little saying on it. The best meme is going to win. So on January 2nd, we're going to go through all those memes and select a winner. To enter the giveaway, send an email to rob@conspiracychannel.net. That includes the meme. And we'll select a winner on January 2nd and send you an email with all the information on how to get the book and your free year subscription to the Conspiracy Channel. And one final thing, this is the last podcast we're going to be doing an audio edition for. We've decided to just focus on video, getting stuff up on YouTube and Conspiracy Channel, Roku and Fire TV. And the extra effort that went into producing the audio podcast just isn't worth it at this point. We want to focus primarily on video. And so we've decided to end it. So if you're listening to this on Stitcher or SoundCloud or one of the other audio platforms, just come over to conspiracychannel.net, click our YouTube button, and you can watch all the videos directly on YouTube. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Anyway, that's it for this week. We'll see you in the new year. I'm Rob Davin. Have a good night.